I will call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order. We'll do the minutes later when the vice chair is not otherwise occupied. Representative Hortman. Representative Hortman, you have a bill, House File 2375. If you don't mind, I'll go ahead and move that House File 2375 be re-referred to the General Register. And there's also an amendment. Is it the DE1, Representative Hortman?
I think it is the DE1.
Why don't we move the DE1, and then you have an oral amendment to incorporate into the DE1, I believe, Representative Hortman?
I do. I would like, if he's willing to, for Mr. Eliff to explain the oral amendment that I will incorporate.
First of all, Representative Hortman moves the DE1 amendment, and then if staff would please explain the amendment we're going to incorporate.
Staff will fess up, Madam Chair. There are actually two oral amendments. The first one on page 2, line 31, deletes the word of and inserts including. Page 2, line 31. And the other oral amendment on page 3, delete section 2. Originally, Section 3 was part of Section 2, and when I separated them, I left Section 2 hanging.
I'd like to incorporate that into the DE1 if there's no objection.
Mr. Eliff, I'm sorry, we're deleting all of the text of Section 2, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Let me ask staff, GOP and DFL staff, do you understand the amendment? Sure. Mr. Eliff, would you please repeat the first part?
Certainly. Page 2, line 31, delete of and insert including.
Okay. Any other questions from staff? Is there any objection to Representative Hortman incorporating this amendment to her amendment? All right. We will incorporate that to the amendment. Representative Hortman, we will now vote on the DE1 amendment, and then you will tell us about your bill as amended. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hortman, we are now on your bill as amended by the DE1 amendment. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the DE1 removed two sections of the bill. We've been working to have peace in the valley with this bill and working hard to try to find agreement on some conservation measures. And with me here today is Mike Bull from the Center for Energy and the Environment, and he will explain what House File 2375 does.
Mr. Bull. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Mike Bull, B-U-L-L. I'm the policy director at the Center for Energy and Environment. With me is Sheldon Strom, president of CEE. We're a nonprofit organization in our 35th year. We work primarily on finding pragmatic, practical solutions on clean energy issues, essentially primarily energy efficiency issues. And on this, on House File 2375, as Representative Hortman mentioned, we initially started out with four initiatives, four components to the bill. We worked very hard with a broad section of stakeholders, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, the Minnesota Renewable, the Rural Electric Cooperatives, Great River Energy, XL, Otter Tail, and on and on. So we have had countless meetings with folks, and we appreciate everyone's willingness to work with us on this legislation. I especially wanted to say thank you to Annette Henkel from the Minnesota Utility Investors. She's been a very great partner in pulling together a number of meetings so we could do this kind of work, finding consensus in a most efficient manner. So what we were able to find consensus, a broad consensus, on two of the provisions, and on two of the provisions we weren't able to. And so after consulting with Representative Portman, we decided to leave aside the ones that we weren't able to find consensus on and move forward with the two that we do have broad agreement. So with the changes that are incorporated in the author's amendment, we have significant consensus on the bill. It's not perfect agreement. I think there are a couple of utilities that, or a couple of entities would like to do something somewhat different, but I think we've worked through everyone's concerns to the best we can. So it's not 100% agreement, but it's pretty darn close. The bill, as I mentioned, has two provisions. The first sets up a framework for on-bill repayment of energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. It's a financing mechanism on a customer premises. And the second provision deals with long-range planning for emissions reduction. And Sheldon's going to talk a little bit about the first provision, the financing provision, and then I'll talk about the emissions planning portion.
Mr. Strom. My name is Sheldon Strom. I'm president of the Center for Energy and Environment. On bill financing and on-bill repayment are relatively old ideas. In the 80s, Minnegasco partnered with the city of Minneapolis to offer a program like this for a number of years. And then NSP offered a program for a number of years into the 90s. And then those programs were discontinued. There's been renewed interest around the country on the issue of on-bill financing or on-bill repayment. And what we've done after talking to utilities over the last few years is try and craft provisions in the bill that facilitate utilities offering this as part of their efficiency programs or renewable energy programs, but doing that in a way that ensures that the utilities and ratepayers are protected. One of the problems in the past with some of the utility financing programs, it was unclear who paid for the defaults. So what happened with some of those programs then, if somebody didn't pay their loan, those costs were transferred to other ratepayers. Another question that came up was, if somebody pays part of their bill, is that credit to their utility bill or to their loan? So all we're trying to do with this legislation, which is permissive legislation, is say that if a utility files an on-bill repayment program with the Department of Energy Resources and wants to get approval of that program, there are certain parameters that will ensure that the costs of that program are not passed on to non-participating ratepayers. In the past, utilities have sometimes funded this with their own capital, and we're not saying they couldn't do that again, but more likely what utilities seem to indicate they'd prefer to do is have another lender provide the loan capital, have the utility service that on an on-bill on the bill, so as a convenience to their customers, but then have the lender who provides this basic capital be responsible for any and all defaults, so that those don't get passed on to non-participating ratepayers. And we also make clear in the bill that no one can be shut off because of non-payment of their loan on their bill. And so it's basically just trying to take advantage of the convenience of the bill. And like I said, it's permissive. Utilities don't have to do this. We're simply saying if a utility chooses to do it, they can be assured that they would have these protections under the bill.
Mr. Ball?
Mr. Chair, on the second provision dealing with long-range emissions reduction planning, we've been working with Wind on the Wires in particular on this provision. We've been talking to everyone. It essentially would ask the utilities as part of their resource plan to take a look at their systems, describe the costs, opportunities, technical barriers the utility expects with regard to continuing to make progress on carbon emissions, and the alternatives the utility is considering to address those challenges. It's not a requirement that the utility continue to reduce emissions. All of our utilities are and will generally continue to reduce their emissions in the near term. It's a planning tool to let us know where they see difficulties on their systems. They know their systems better than any of us, us interveners in the Public Utilities Commission parlance. So the idea is a planning tool to let us know where they see difficulties in the future with regard to reducing their emissions. The idea came to me when I was a resource planner at Xcel Energy. We were putting together the 2010 resource plan that for Xcel's system up here in the north, and we realized, talking to Betsy Engelking, the director of resource planning at the time, that the operating licenses of the nuclear facilities would expire outside the 5 and 15 year time horizon for resource planning. Just for everybody's information, resource plans, utilities provide a 5 and 15 year look to the Public Utilities Commission of the actions they're expecting to take in that time period to meet customer demand in a way that meets state and federal regulations. So it's a 5 and 15 year look. But there are a number of things that are happening on utility systems outside that time frame that it would be good for all of us to have some information about, so that we have a public discussion about various aspects of utility systems, and as those things that are outside the action period, the 5 and 15 year period, as those come into those into the 5 and 15 year period for commission approval, we will have had some public discussion about what to do, what alternatives the utilities are thinking, so that it's not a surprise to the regulators, we're able to take action that makes sense. With regard to the nuclear plants in particular, the idea there was that to replace that significant amount of essentially carbon-free generation, it's going to take a long lead time in order to figure out what should be done in order to replace that generation. If we go along as we currently are, it's most likely going to be a lot of natural gas, a lot of natural gas on to replace those facilities, and that would increase Xcel's reliance on natural gas significantly, but it would also make it impossible for them to continue to reduce their carbon emissions. And it's likely that, that's the most significant example, but it's likely that all the utilities have some issue that are maybe much smaller but still important that they would be able to identify for us in a relatively simple narrative discussion to let us know what those issues are, what costs they see, what alternatives they're considering, so that we're able to do some public discussion about that in a relatively non-adversarial way. And that's the proposal. So while we don't have 100% agreement on this provision, but we do have significant sign-off, Xcel Energy, Minnesota Power, Great River Cooperative, Ottertail Power, they have all signed off on this, and we appreciate their hard work. With regard to both of these provisions, we appreciate the time and attention that all the stakeholders have provided us in working through these issues, in their good faith in helping us craft language that works for them. It's been a really good process. We've learned more about our bill than we knew when we dropped it in, and we hope it's a good example going forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bull. Representative Quam, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a couple, and I appreciate that the testifier touched on the nuclear facility being carbon-free. I think we should also include the word baseline, because that adds a little bit of difficulty in replacing, and option-wise, and I think we might have to readdress some of the carbon targets with that proportionality of generation within the state. But the question that I have for the testifiers is looking at the DE amendment, and in here where it mentions lender must purchase back loans in delinquency or default, the risk of default must remain with the lender. Is there any issue with this approach to FDIC or state regulatory agencies on banks of you know, forcing them to have exposure and limiting their recourse, and then affecting the solubility, you know, the basically how well the bank can handle that.
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Strom. This program is voluntary, and any participating lenders would participate voluntarily. And the idea is that what we're trying to do is not change the relationship between the lender and their customer. So the lender would be responsible for selecting the customer, its creditworthiness, and so on. The only difference is that the bill would be repaid by the customer on their utility bill. And this provision is trying to solidify that it's really no different than any other loan except for the convenience of paying it on the utility bill. So that provision is to make sure the utility and utility customers aren't involved in that in any way. So the idea is that it would be just like any other loan. The difference would be instead of servicing it by mail or sending in checks, it would be serviced on the utility bill. And if a lender didn't want to participate in that, then they wouldn't participate in it.
Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Bull.
Yep. I could just add, we have reached out to the Bankers Association a couple of times to talk with them about this and let us know if they felt they had any issues with the provisions, and they have not to date.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can staff let me know what agencies at the state have jurisdiction over payment methods and, you know, allowing this interactions and stipulations, you know, on banks and loans? Is that the normal purview of the PUC, or is that Commerce or one of the other agencies?
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it is the Commerce Department that regulates banking in the state to the extent it's regulated.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, then am I under the assumption that the Commerce Chair has been consulted and has no issues with wanting to have this topic before his committee? Is why we're going to the General Registry with this?
Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, the Chair of the Commerce Committee has not given me any indication he would like to see the bill.
Representative Quam?
I understand the reply, and we can go on.
Okay, thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is probably for Mr. Bull, but first a comment, Mr. Bull. You observed that there was some peace in the valley, and you listed the companies that were ostensibly have signed off on the modification here. I see they're not on the testifier list either. However, everyone you identified is an IOU, and they have a fiduciary relationship with their stockholders, not with their customers. They're out to defend their stockholders. So anything that happens in Subdivision 2, they do, understanding that they have to go to the PUC and defend their ability to raise capital, be reliable, and all that stuff. But when they go back home, they have to defend themselves, the people who own stock in their company. I noticed that the two that did not sign off actually represent real people, members, ratepayers, that this stuff will impact directly. That's just a comment and observation. Know that some members of the committee see that and get it. I got two questions for you,
Mr. Chair
and Mr. Bull. Well, if you want to comment on the comment, you're welcome. But, Mr. Chair, I do have two questions.
Go ahead, Representative Beard. Ask your questions. And then, Mr. Bull, you can comment as you answer the questions as well. Go ahead, Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bull, in this Section 3 as it's rewritten, each utility is required to file yada, yada, but they're identifying costs, opportunities, and barriers, technical barriers, you say, but then the last sentence you refer to barriers again. Does this allow the utilities to identify the changing political landscape from interveners such as yourself? Because I know I've been here 12 years, and I've seen the interveners being all over the map with whatever the favorite flavor of the month is. And sometimes that can be really challenging to a utility that, as you know and as you mentioned, needs 7 to 14-year timelines. They want constancy and stability. We've given them anything but. Can they identify those things and talk about these in these plans?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, yes. You know, so we wanted to give – part of the idea here is actually to provide them an opportunity for an honest discussion from their perspective. what they see on their systems with regard to continuing to reduce their emissions. So it's as I mentioned, they know their systems better than anyone else. One thing I wanted to point out is we did work really closely with Great River Energy, mm-hmm. And they are a cooperative association, and they've signed off on this language as well. We have talked with Southern Minnesota Municipal Utility Association. I don't want to represent their interests, but I haven't heard additional concerns from them either. So on your initial point.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Representative Beard, you had one more question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bull, for clarifying that. We should chat about GRE another time, but that's it's helpful to know that they've signed off on this. This is actually, I see it's long-range emission reduction is actually the subdivision it's under, but it was filed originally under the Integrated Resource Plan, which led to my next question about the carbon-free objective that we have actually written in state law. Might this actually be possible for them to identify that it's impossible to achieve that, whether because of physics, chemistry, or finances? Could that be one of the conclusions they could draw when they're trying to comply with new subdivision 2C?
Mr. Bull.
Chair, Representative Beard, we didn't want to foreclose that option for those four folks. You know, I think that they're going to want to do what they can to let us know where they can make progress and where they will have difficulty. And I think that my sense of our discussions is that everybody intends to do just that. And if it's impossible, I think that they would let us know if they think it's impossible.
And to be clear, just to understand, would they intend to do just that? I mean, they intend to be transparent and forthright with their conclusions they're drawing? That's what you mean?
Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. There are two more testifiers on my list of testifiers, Ms. Wafel and Mr. Johnson. You two can toss a coin, decide who's going to go first, but we would love to hear from you and the organizations you represent.
If you don't mind.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, my name is Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, which is made up of the 44 distribution co-ops and the 6 G&Ts that provide electricity in Minnesota. First off, I'd like to thank the author, Representative Hortman, and the staff at CEE, Mike and Brian and Sheldon, for their openness and willingness to work with all of the stakeholders in this process. It really was a refreshing way to work out legislation. And I think we've come up with language here with the changes that pretty much all of the stakeholders can support. A couple of examples coming in. We were concerned at some of the specificity in the on-bill repayment language, particularly as it pertains to co-ops. The farm bill that passed just this February in Washington includes a fairly large amount of money for no-interest loans that will be available to co-ops that we can offer our members to help pay for conservation and renewable energy sources. And early on in the process, we were concerned that the language in the original bill was too prescriptive and would eliminate that type of flexibility. We voiced our concerns, and I think the language that we have now, which one provides more flexibility for co-ops and munis and recognizes our different regulatory structure and allows our boards to decide what those programs look like, we really appreciate the work and the concessions that were made on that issue. With that said, we still have some concerns with the IRP reporting. I think everyone in this room will agree that it is appropriate for all of us to have a long conversation about what it's going to cost, what to reduce greenhouse emissions, what it's going to do to if we continue to pursue a 0% goal. And we're concerned somewhat that this is placed in the IRP. However, there is also other provisions that have been added to the IRP recently that address some of these things down the road. We can live with this. And again, overall, this is a bill that we do support, and we really do appreciate the process and the way that this bill was put together. And we hope it can be a model for moving forward on other energy-related legislation.
Thank you. Ms. Weifel. And then we'll do questions after Ms. Weifel. Is that okay? Representative Groffler, we'll keep Mr. Johnson up there. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Elizabeth Weifel. I'm a lobbyist with Flaherty and Hood. I am here on behalf of Missouri River Energy Services, which is a municipal power agency covering a four-state area, and we provide supplemental power to 24 municipal utilities in western Minnesota. Deb Bergen sends her apologies. She's out in D.C. with the American Public Power Association this week. And I would actually echo a lot of what Mr. Johnson said. This procedure that we went through, you know, with Representative Hortman and the representatives from CEE was remarkable. Haven't been through that sort of process where we've been able to sit down and really sort of hammer through some of our differences there. So we really appreciate the opportunity to work on a bill like that. And we're not standing here opposed to this bill, but like Mr. Johnson, we do want to express our concern about the section with respect to the IRP. Again, just repeating what he said, that there were changes made to the IRP in the energy bill last year that addressed some of these issues, and it's also addressed in a number of other locations. To the extent that even further discussion is necessary, we think that could probably take place you know, at the LEC, also, or perhaps as part of the MK group going forward. So we'd rather see that somewhere else and not included, but overall we also lend our support. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Groffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I also, too, want to compliment Representative Hortman on the collaborative process. And my question for the two testifiers up there, is the utility industry working on a time machine to go back to last session and get Representative Hortman to do the exact same thing back then, or is that not on the table? That was a much more funny joke in my head when I said it than the reaction.
Representative Groffler has a question about time machines, Representative Hortman. Do you want to answer that?
The testifiers, and that is how many times do we have pancakes together? So, I mean, it's not like we didn't try. Just some things you can't find common ground on.
We did have pancakes a lot. Just ask my bathroom scale.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Chairman, just a serious question to the testifiers.
Representative Garofalo.
Can you, for me, just highlight the those items that you're required to do in this bill versus the ones that are give you the option of choosing to do them, and kind of highlight some of those so that people understand not everything in this bill is telling you to do everything?
Mr. Johnson? Who's? Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, all of the requirements under the on-bill repayment programs are voluntary and remain under control of local co-op boards and the governing bodies for the municipals as well. Electric co-ops, the IRP process is advisory only. It's a somewhat different process than it is for the IOUs. We have been assured that this is not going to affect the changes that were made for the IRP process specifically for Basin and Dairyland a few years ago.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Members, there are two amendments in your packet, the A1 and the A2. The A2, as I understand it, was covered by the DE1. The DE1 was just the delete everything form of the A2 amendment. But I believe Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will withdraw the A1. I think there's a little more work that needs to be done on this. So,
thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein withdraws the A1 amendment. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill as amended? See people returning to their seats, but nobody's stepping down. Are there any more questions from the committee? Representative Hortman, would you like to have a few last words?
I would renew my motion.
Representative Hortman renews her motion that House File 2375 be referred as amended to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Hortman, your bill's on its way.
Next bill on the calendar for the day. No, just kidding. Next bill on the committee's agenda is House File 1174. Representative Falk moves that House File 1174 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection and Finance, or Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. And Representative Falk has the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like it.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And the A1 amendment, it simply changes the date from 2013 to 2014, and it... Because the Midwest Independent System Operator changed their name, it updates the references to them so that they are accurate. So that's purely technical amendment. That's what it does. So, would appreciate getting the bill in the shape.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this is a bill that we actually had as... put in the omnibus energy bill last year, and working on that, the provisions were just not quite, you know, move forward at the in the omnibus bill at that time. What this does is this bill deals with upgrading the distributed generation interconnection standards we have in the state of Minnesota. They were last updated in 2001, and we've had some significant changes in the energy landscape since that point in time. It's really purely technical, and you know, if we're going to encourage distributed generation, one of the things we should be doing is making it as easy as possible for folks to get those projects put online. I remember last session we had Representative Lilly here with a bill, I think it was House File 337, that dealt with property tax exemptions for generating facilities owned by municipal power agencies. But remember the testimony that the municipals gave, basically citing all of the advantages of distributed generation: lower costs, avoiding the transmission system, some of these things that were really advantageous to their managing their systems, and also hopefully lowering some rates for consumers. What this does is basically just tries to make those DG interconnection procedures easier, and then also when there are different benefits that are noticeable because of the DG resource, whether it's you're saving because you're not having to go and use a congested transmission system, if you're avoiding to have to build additional transmission infrastructure, and just kind of the role that the overall transmission system has and how DG can interconnect and just have interconnect or have relationships with that make the system ultimately work better. And a lot of what we talked about in the value of solar tariff that was enacted last session is kind of reflective of this. This is on a slightly larger scale because we're talking about current DG interconnection, which I believe go up to 10 megawatts. And these are standards we already have on the books, but we are updating them to go in and be more reflective of the current environment. And then ultimately, when there are savings and other costs that are beneficial to the utility as a result of these DG interconnections, that some of those financial incentives should be reflected back to either the entity developing the resource or the entity operating the resource. And you know, we're not saying that all the costs and all the savings have to go back to them, but when we put this into the tariff, I mean, if you're ultimately saving the whole system resources, you should, I think, as the entity developing that DG interconnection, receive part of that. This could be a solar installation, it could be a wind turbine installation, but it could also be things like a cogeneration facility. So we're just kind of updating the rules by which people are playing. One of the things, too, I'm not sure if folks had a chance to see this, but FERC has actually done something kind of similar to this. This was an article I saw in early January of 2014, but They've kind of adopted some of the fast-track rules that California had implemented regarding DG interconnections. And so this is kind of reflective a little bit of that effort, but done at our state level. And ultimately, our state has authority to go and manage its distribution system or the transmission or the grid essentially under 100,000 kV voltages. Above that, you fall more into FERC jurisdiction. But this is saying, what can we do with our jurisdiction under 100,000 kV? How can we best optimize our system? I do have John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance with me. He would like to offer some comments on the bill. I'd ask him to come down at this time.
Sure. We have one question so far. Representative Quam, we have two questions so far.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, you mentioned in the equation working in the savings from the district. What about if there happens to be some cost of the location, because frequently it might not be in the most opportune part of the grid, and so if there are any additional costs that can be calculated and submitted, are they also being taken into consideration?
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And part of this, I mean, we're asking the utilities to identify optimal locations as one of the things, but we currently have a tariff, and a tariff is basically a rate that is paid for an interconnection on a current DG interconnection. There is a rate paid. We are asking for that rate to be updated to reflect the current situation. And basically, as we've learned more, that if you can avoid, say, transmission costs or building additional transmission infrastructure, but overall saves the system money, perhaps that cost should be considered as going into that tariff rate. We already have a tariff rate. This is asking it to just basically include additional factors that we have identified to have value.
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I didn't hear a yes or no that if there are additional costs, that's figured in, as long as, you know, I heard the word saving. I didn't hear cost, and I heard a bunch of other words, but no yes or no. Is there a yes or no that it would be part of the equation, or you only have a one-sided consideration of the impact?
Well, Representative Falk.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, part of the reason why we asked the commission to do this work is because they're the ones that have the expertise to go and weigh the benefits. So I wouldn't have the expertise to comment on that, because the tariff or the commission has to go through the process.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since the testifier and author could comment one way but isn't justified in commenting the other way, would you be unjustified to make some of the statements you previously made?
Representative Falk.
Madam Chair, I have no idea what Representative Quam is asking.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and the author, I just want to clarify to the author, this bill was contained in the Omnibus Energy Bill that passed off the floor last session, is that correct?
No, it was, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, we had it in the bill that went out of this committee, and in the negotiations, I know that there was a number of areas that were being worked on. Their provisions were removed from the omnibus bill that passed off the floor. It did pass out of this committee without dissent, and I don't believe it at the time anybody testified against it, but there were a number of other issues. I think the kind of focus on solar became the predominant issue and the parts that people wanted to focus most of their efforts on. So, you know, things that were ancillary to that or, you know, could detract from that effort, I think were somewhat lessened to make it, you know, easier.
Representative Garofalo did come up over pancakes. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, yeah, so at what point in the process was this provision removed from the bill?
Representative Falk.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, you'd have to ask the chairwoman.
Madam Chair.
Representative Falk, I believe I either removed it before it went out of this committee or I removed it before it moved through Commerce. I think it was in my first amendment in the Commerce Committee.
Okay, so Madam Chair, just to be clear, with the thanks. Just to be clear, this is not a provision that we could see attached to another energy bill in conference committee. So last session we saw some things that passed in one body and then sort of dropped out of the sky in the conference committee. I think of Senate office building, these sales tax provisions. This would not be an item that would be able to meet that standard this session. It would, in fact, have to pass off the full House floor again in order. We don't need to. The reason why I say that is for all the, obviously we have quite a few people here watching this, that every single energy conference committee that's going to be taking place, they don't need to worry about this provision just showing up in those conference committees.
Representative Garofalo, I think the joint rules of the House and Senate, which, you know, I don't know that people always abide by, do require that any provision that ends up in a conference committee report has to have passed off the floor of one or the other of the bodies. To my understanding, this provision has not passed off the floor of either body at this point in time, so it is not eligible for inclusion in a conference committee report.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Sure, if I could offer, too, I mean, this is a standalone bill. It's being run through the normal process. So, I mean, that's why it's going to be referred to Chair Atkins Commerce Committee where we can continue to work on it. So.
Yep, but Madam Chair, as I was just
Representative Garofalo,
as has been highlighted several times, we've seen bills fall out of the sky in the last year, and it's just important for members or for the public to understand that if there's another energy bill being debated or there's another conference committee, they do not need to worry about this bill being attached to another conference committee unless it has passed off the House or Senate floor.
So. In the interest of bipartisan compromise, we could agree that we're not going to talk about the Senate office building in the Energy Policy Committee, and I won't talk about a locked Capitol in 2011. It is a bipartisan compromise. Any other questions about the bill to the author? And then we'll have some testimony. We can have further discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, I think with the testimony would be useful to help answer questions.
Go ahead. Really? Please bring your first testifier.
Really? Wow.
I'm not as funny as you, Representative Garofalo, so if we make this deal, it's actually better for me.
Yeah, you're also not as controversial on Twitter as I am.
This is true. I only tweet about energy. Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Farrell. I'm the Director of Democratic Energy Small D Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And I have just a prepared statement on sort of the general benefits of distributed generation as could be reflected in the improvements in this bill. The first category of those is, as Representative Faulk mentioned, implementation of best practices. As he mentioned, these interconnection standards have not been updated for 13 years. A great deal has changed nationally and in the state of Minnesota around the opportunities from distributed generation, its cost effectiveness, and as he mentioned, many of the provisions are very similar to what was adopted by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's small generator interconnection procedures over the past 6 months. I think there are two pieces worth highlighting. One is the use of evidence-based screening tools to facilitate faster processing of distributed generation applications focused on both the capacity of the power lines and the size of the generation using tools that make it as easy as possible for generators to know whether or not their project would fit within guidelines that would make it easy to interconnect. And then the second piece would be optimizing distributed generation to the most suitable areas of the grid, as was alluded to in some earlier questions, by providing developers of distributed generation projects or utilities with more information about the most cost-effective places to interconnect. So there are a couple of good best practices opportunities. The second area I just wanted to emphasize is the opportunity for cost savings that, as I have testified to previously, electricity costs have been rising rather rapidly for Minnesota customers, averaging about a 4% per year increase over the past decade. There have been some rather significant increases to retail costs just in the past couple of years. And on-site generation for many technologies is providing a cost-effective and competitive alternative for homes and businesses to meet their energy needs, solar being just one of them, but as probably most standout in terms of its cost changes, the cost of a solar panel has fallen by about 60% in just the last 3 years, and installation costs for solar fell by 15% in 2013 alone. Utilities are also increasingly realizing the benefits of distributed renewable energy resources. The value of solar provision in the solar energy standard last year has been played out through the Department of Commerce's stakeholder process, and some of the initial outcomes from that suggest that it could be in the ballpark of about 14 cents per kilowatt hour from that distributed resource, which is about 15 to 20% higher than what customers, residential customers, pay for electricity. So it's just a reflection of some of the opportunity there in terms of the value simply to the utility of that distributed resource. There are a couple of other, I think, prominent examples we're sharing. The Long Island Power Authority, the utility in New York serving Long Island, calculated that a recent solicitation that they put out for about 100 megawatts of distributed solar resource would would save the utility over $100 million in transmission line and other infrastructure upgrades that would have otherwise been required to deliver power to customers on Long Island. Another good example is the Farmers Electric Cooperative in southeastern Iowa has about 600 to 700 customers, but has nearly 20% of their customers participating in local energy generation, which actually helps them manage the risk of buying power on wholesale energy markets. So there's an opportunity there for smaller utilities to help manage energy demand. And, of course, recent headlines in Minnesota also emphasize the opportunity that, a proposal to meet peak energy demands with solar in Minnesota was won out over a proposal to do so with natural gas power plants in the Dakotas. Just one final area I think that's worth highlighting in terms of economic benefits, distributed energy resources reinforce a tradition of self-reliance that has been pioneered by, for example, the state's electric cooperatives and municipal utilities. 80 years ago, residents of near Alexandria, Minnesota, for example, went door-to-door collecting $5 investments so that a cooperative utility could bring electricity service to farms, boosting productivity in the local economy. 80 years ago, electricity was the means for economic development, and today, electricity itself is a source of an economic development. Homes and businesses are using local distributed power generation from wind or solar or natural gas cogeneration to keep home some of the $20 billion a year that Minnesota customers of energy export to pay for fossil fuel energy, and they're using those dollars to create local jobs. In conclusion, I just want to emphasize that I believe that this bill doesn't make any dramatic changes to the state's electricity policy, but really focuses on making it easier for homes and businesses and utilities to provide access to competitive and cost-effective electricity service. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions to the testifier? Okay, if not, we have, I think, three other testifiers. And there might be questions for you later, Mr. Farrell, as the discussion proceeds. I seem to have lost my list. Mr. Padden from Great River Energy. Sorry. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Greg Padden. I'm the Director of Resources and Utility Markets at Great River Energy. We are a not-for-profit electric cooperative that is owned by and serves 28 member cooperatives across the state of Minnesota. It is our nation's policy that the electric transmission grid provide non-discriminatory open access to all generators. That is the system we have in place today, and it is coordinated by independent system operators like MISO. Great River Energy and its member cooperatives are opposed to House File 1174. The proposed changes would create a confusing duplication of requirements and potential to circumvent or conflict with MISO's generator interconnection process, which has been reviewed and approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Minnesota's statewide interconnection process for distributed generation was developed through an extensive, consensus-oriented stakeholder process and has worked well for nearly a decade. This standardized process prioritizes grid safety and reliability through a coordinated approach to generator interconnection. Interconnection requests are processed at a utility level and only escalated to MISO if they have the potential to impact the larger transmission grid. Many of the proposed changes in this bill appear to be directed towards public utilities in Minnesota. However, because Minnesota has been a leader in development of an integrated transmission grid, all utilities, including cooperatives and municipal systems, would be impacted by the proposed changes. For example, one provision would result in expanding the statewide interconnection process to electric systems with voltages of 100 kilovolts or KV. But there are many transmission lines within Minnesota that operate at much lower voltages, 69 KV or even 41 KV. Another proposed change would cause utilities to develop and maintain a separate shadow queue in parallel with MISO's interconnection queue. These changes would create confusion and inevitable conflict with MISO's generator interconnection process. They are good examples of why it is not possible to make changes to public utility interconnection standards without affecting all electric utilities connected to such an integrated system. We are also very concerned about the proposed changes to annual distributed generation reporting requirements. Today, utilities report facts. about things that actually occurred in the preceding year. The new proposed requirement is significantly different. It would require utilities to submit not a report, but an opinion on potential locations for future distributed generation. Such opinions would have to be based on a set of assumptions that could only reflect one possible future. This overly simplistic approach ignores the realities of a dynamic, integrated, and interconnected electric grid. In addition, the concept of an optimal location is both undefined and greatly influenced by the capabilities of the DG systems being contemplated. Optimal can appear very different depending on the perspective from which it is viewed, system reliability, demand reduction, load following, financial value. Each one has a different measure of optimal. Finally, there is the potential for such information to be used adversely by third parties whose intent it is to undermine local reliability instead of improve it. In conclusion, Great River Energy and our member cooperatives are opposed to changes that would provide preferential treatment to certain generators or create shortcuts to MISO processes that support safety and reliability of the electric grid. Minnesota's current interconnection process strikes an appropriate balance between local control and system-wide coordination. If a generator impacts larger transmission grid, then MISO is the entity best able to assess those impacts. I've heard it said, there is a reason cars are made with only one steering wheel. And that seems to be an apt summary of our concerns. We encourage you to vote against this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. There are five more testifiers. Representative Falk, do you want to wait until they've all concluded and then do a rebuttal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'd just ask a couple questions of Mr. Patton. One, do we currently have a DG process in place in the state of Minnesota that allows these type of interconnections to go forward?
Mr. Patton.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, there is a statewide interconnection process for distributed generation, yes.
Mr. Falk, or Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's be clear, we're updating current procedures, and if you actually read the bill here, when we talk about impacting the MISO system, it's on 2.23 through 2.27. Basically, if you have a distribution system and you have the ability to put generation on the grid so it doesn't impact the transmission system, so it doesn't have to go through MISO, that's what we're trying to update here. And so all the talk about MISO and what 2.23 through 2.27 talks about, it says establish a procedure whereby when the size of a distributed generation resource causes power flow intermittently into transmission facilities operated by the Midwest Independent System Operator, the local load-serving utility may coordinate with the Midwest Independent System Operator to conduct the interconnection transmission system analysis and transmission system usage reservations. That's not changing. And so the current transmission process, which going through MISO is incredibly expensive and it's incredibly bloated, and under FERC rule, we have the authority, actually it's designated that under 100,000 kV interconnections are the jurisdiction of within the state. Above that, you get into the FERC jurisdictions. MISO has in the past stated that some of these smaller interconnections would be much easier handled by other entities than them, i.e. states. And so what we're trying to do here is if you're trying to put on a cogen facility where you're not going to touch a transmission system, you're putting on a couple megawatts there, and the overall substation minimum loads are, say, 20 MVA, and you're putting on a couple megawatts of generation, there's no practical possibility of that power getting onto the transmission system. You should be able to interconnect that power much more easily and readily, and also by requiring these additional criteria that they have to go and account for the savings because you're not having to go and draw down as much power from the transmission system when it's congested. That should be put into the tariff that is paid for that generate that DG power. This is, you know, I have issue with a lot of the comments made because I think this is being portrayed as something that it's not, because we are trying to make the DG process easier and make it work smoother for people and avoid the transmission system interconnection process, because we know how long MISO takes. It takes oftentimes years and hundreds of thousands of dollars to go through. And part of, you know, what FERC has adopted through the changes that were done in California, it talks about utilities having a $300 pre-application for requesting parties and changing the size from, I think it was 2 to up to 5 megawatts. And so is some movement to the federal level, but there's a lot of things we can do at the state level to make this process a lot easier for folks. Sure, it's beneficial for things like solar, you know, a wind turbine here or there, but the cogen facilities make an absolute ton of sense. And I get back to the point where if you've got a manufacturer or somebody that's, you know, the potential for an implicate or where you can install a cogen facility, why wouldn't you want the utility to go and say that might be an optimum resource? Because there's additional system benefits we can all benefit from.
And Mr. Patton, if you want to respond to that, and then we'll go through the five testifiers and have Representative Falk respond to them in bulk. But Mr. Patton, since you're there, and the conversation has started.
Madam Chair and Representative Falk, I guess I didn't hear a question, so I'm sorry if there was a question I was
there
supposed
was not,
to answer.
There was a response.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Evans from Xcel Energy. And Mr. Limoges. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. With me is Joe Limoges, and I thought we'd just come down together. I'm going to make a couple of comments, and I'm going to turn it over to him. I'm going to talk about two sections of the bill that haven't been discussed yet, and then turn it over to Joe. The two sections I want to talk about, I want to first of all put in some context. In to a great degree, the omnibus bill that we all worked so hard on last year was a bill to change distributed generation. You recall we changed the net metering limits. You recall that we created the alternative tariff. We created the concept, or adopted the concept, of the value of solar. All of those things in a large and, as you can all remember, a controversial bill that eventually came out with a fair amount of agreement in order to find a new way to handle distributed generation on our system. In some ways, to be honest with you, I'm having a little deja vu, because many of the issues that are addressed in this bill were issues that we tried to address or did address last year. The first one, which is relatively minor, but I think it's important for the committee to consider, is on line 235. We change, in this bill, we would change a may to a shall. And what the shall is it requires the commission to create an incentive program for utilities to do certain things that will integrate distributed generation on their system. Now, that's not altogether bad. If you create an incentive system, we'll look at it and see whether the incentive is worth it and take the steps that we think is worth it to earn the incentive. But don't be mistaken. You're creating a cost for our customers that they would pay to incentivize us to do what you largely required us to do last year. If you think about the current incentive that we have in conservation, it's a somewhat controversial thing. We like it. We like earning the incentive. We think we do a good job, and we think the incentive helps. But it seems to me that if you're going to adopt a new incentive addressed toward DG, that would be something that would be done in a much more comprehensive way than the way it's addressed in this bill. But more importantly, the author and the earlier testifier referred to this, and that is what's on line 2.30 to 2.34. We worked a long time, I think you'll all recall, last year on creating a value of solar. It was a new concept, a way to see if we could introduce solar DG on the system in a way different from net metering. We increased the net metering limit to 1 megawatt. We said you can do net metering or you can do the alternative tariff with the value of solar. We had hours of conversation and discussion about that. And since the bill was passed, the PUC has had hours of conversation and discussion along with the department and all the stakeholders on how to create that. As I recall, we even had a conversation back then about whether we wanted to create a value of wind and a value of biomass and incorporate those in the bill so that we could move into this new direction. And those were rejected with the decision that, you know what, let's try it out with solar and see how it works. Let's not jump in. What this bill would do is have us pay system benefits. It's not even as well defined as the value of solar, but presumably incorporates many of the same things, and not limited at 1 megawatt, but all the way up to 10 megawatts, and not limited to solar, but for every other kind of of resource that might come along. It seems to me that those two sections of the bill alone undermine everything we tried to do last year in sort of this experiment that we're launching on solar. Suddenly the commission is going to have to start a new value of distributed generation process and create a value of generation tariff for every possible resource based on system benefits, which are not even very clearly defined. Those two paragraphs alone create a problem in this bill that, in our opinion, makes it very difficult to go forward with all of the things that we did last year. It just makes it that much more complicated. And for that reason, we would urge that the bill not be approved. I'd like to turn over to Mr. Limoges so he can talk a little bit about some of the more technical aspects of the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Joel Limoges, L-I-M-O-G-E-S. I'm the manager of distribution engineering for Xcel Energy in the north. I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Minnesota and several other states. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to discuss this with you. I'm going to address two parts of this bill. The first is lines 2.23 through 2.27. It says in the bill that the utility may coordinate. I think we need a little more definition of what that means. I also want to urge you to understand what that's going to be. That's going to be very problematic for the utility to intercede on the developer's behalf with MISO. These are technical discussions. It seems rather inefficient for an engineer at the host utility to be talking to the developer trying to get technical parameters and then take them to MISO and be this intermediary. Yes, the MISO process is a little more thorough than the utility process, and that's why we just don't think it's right for the host utility to enter into that discussion. Secondly, I'd like to address Subdivision 3, paragraph 4, about keeping a map where there are good opportunities for distributed generation. This request has been heard and discussed several times as we processed last year's solar mandate. We just finished a hearing at the commission within the last 2 weeks on this. It is a very expensive thing to do. It's also very difficult to keep it updated. Almost as soon as you publish it, it's out of date. The electric system is dynamic, changing on a daily basis. And in the past, in the value of solar and the most recent solar tariffs, the commission has elected not to have utilities keep such a map up. And then the third thing I want to address is this issue about the interconnection policies not having been updated. As part of the last year's solar bill, we're just wrapping up hearings. There have been tweaks to the solar or the interconnection process since 2001, but recently at a hearing with the PUC, almost all stakeholders stood up and expressed satisfaction with the existing interconnection process. We know that there's been some issues with the application process, which is different than the interconnection process. So those are my comments today.
Question, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is really more of a question for you. As I recall, the first few meetings we had, you expressed your interest in only hearing bills that were going to be so-called peace in the valley, that there would be bipartisan support. And so I'm hearing this, and I'm sensing that that's not happening. And so I just wondered if you didn't know that this bill was going to cause people's feathers to be ruffled, or if there's been a change in heart on your part.
Representative Scott, Representative Falk made a pretty compelling argument that he thought this would be a positive step forward. And, kind of leave it in members' hands when they bring bills to the committee to work with advocates on both sides. You know, if it proves that it's not non-controversial, then that's what it is. But my understanding was Representative Falk felt that this would be a positive step forward, and he thought there might be some consensus around that.
And, Madam Chair, if I could
offer Falk.
Too. Thank you. We had this passed into the omnibus bill with no dissent at the time. Now, granted, if the folks had some issues, I wish they would have contacted me. I will say that the only utility that did contact me with any concerns was Missouri River Energy Services. And so, this has been posted, so if somebody wanted to come to meet with me, I'm willing to take them and talk about it and listen to their concerns, but nobody reached out, so I'm going to take that as a little bit of, I think there's more of an effort to make an issue out of this, because really what we're doing is updating standards that have been in place since 2001, and they should reflect the current situation. And the fact of the matter is yes, we did this for solar, but when we're talking about the current DG tariff, it's a little bit different than the solar. Solar is kind of its own separate thing. Every other form of energy we have, shouldn't you be able to go and kind of take account for the changes that have happened over the last 14 years or 13 years?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, according to Mr. LaMosh here, there is broad consensus among the stakeholders that what we have right now seems to be working. In fact, he said in a recent meeting, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I guess I'm just disappointed that we're hearing a bill that's so controversial, and maybe you didn't know it. I guess people are coming out now, but I would just like to see this bill held over. I don't think we should move forward.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers? We have Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3, 3.32 to 3.35, and then it continues on the next page, one of the testifiers mentioned the difficulty of this word optimal, and I tend to agree that's not a trivial concern, because when you're really trying to find an optimum for something, you've got to know what you're trying to maximize and which things are your constraints. And it's quite clear that technical feasibility would be a constraint, but it isn't clear which one of these things would be maximized, or is there supposed to be some formula for it or whatever. And so it would be difficult to comply with it as it's currently written, to prove that you had found the one and only optimal, because someone else might have a different idea of that. And so I think that either needs to be softened up in terms of, describing desirable or feasible or something locations, or whatever the heck optimal means has got to be defined, I think.
I'll take that as more of a comment than a question. Let's let the last three testifiers go and give us their views and have some more discussion. Mr. Kimball from Minnesota Power. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak today. My name is Chuck Kimball. I am the Manager of Distribution Resources at Minnesota Power. I'm here today to speak against House File 1174. I have some concerns with what I've read. In my career at Minnesota Power, my goals in the distribution system have been to provide safe, reliable, and reasonably priced power for our customers. A large part of what I am struggling with is again the softness or the ambiguity of some of the terms in here. Maximum penetration. I'm not sure what maximum penetration is. Is it a percentage of the capacity of a line? Is it some number of customers that it will serve? I'm not exactly sure. That's on line 213. One thing that as I go through and look at my concerns that I guess I want to bring to the committee and let people understand is that the bill in a large part endeavors to make the process simple, to make the process easy, to make connecting to the system simple. The reality is the system is not simple. It is a largely interconnected, very powerful, and to a large degree stable system that we have worked years and years and years to make that way. When we start looking at adding resources to it, anywhere from 1 kW up to 10 megawatts, each one of those brings vastly different technical sort of challenges and coordinations with it. And so without a much a smaller range of sizes that we're going to be talking about, to say that you need to give locations or somehow map, as we talk about on line 332, all of the locations where this would be optimal is verging on impossible. It is just too large of an undertaking to not need an entire new staff to work just on that. It also changes on a very regular basis, and so that would be a large and arduous process to keep up to date. On line 3.3, again, it talks about steps taken to reduce barriers, financial, technical, and interconnection. Again, I want to point out this is not a simple system. We've not hired staffs of engineers and taken people who have years of training to work on it because it's easy to do. If it was easy to do, it would be done far and wide. And it's for that reason that it is in large part a difficult and expensive system to connect to. So, as I look at the provisions in this bill, and I look at what they are trying to get to, I see them being in a large part at odds with that safe, reliable, and reasonably priced system. So again, I will ask that in your consideration of file 1174 that you vote against that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Lauren Lautag. I never say your name right. Lautag? From Otter Tail. You'd think I'd have it by now. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You did very well with my last name, actually. It's not all Norwegians can be Olsons or Johnsons, I suppose. So, for the record, Madam Chair, I'm Lauren Lautag with Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls. We serve electricity to western Minnesota and to customers in North and South Dakota. Otter Tail Power currently provides about 19% of its total energy requirements from wind energy. So to the degree that this bill supporting small generation is about wind, I need to express my concerns here today. The bill would, I think, elevate the importance, or let's say the public policy mission, of small distributed generation. And so I want the committee members to think about that in juxtaposition to my company's mission is a little different. Our official mission statement says that we seek to produce and deliver electricity as reliably, economically, and environmentally responsibly as possible. And so with that in mind, all of the bills that we view and review here at the legislature, we are keeping in mind the competitiveness of our customers in world markets, and I would say that on behalf of every customer who is either an industrial customer to the smallest residential customer. They all need to be competitive wherever they are. So the current priorities in the statute that's being referenced here, 216B.1611, as I read it, these are the public policy priorities in this statute. To provide safety, reliability, and consistent treatment of distributed generation applicants with respect to their entrance into the market. Now, in contrast, I think that the bill before us does some important things to change public policy priorities. First of all, in 2.13, as a previous testifier identified, to encourage max penetration of distributed generation. That's potentially a public policy priority. Is that the priority of this committee and of this legislature? In on lines 2.23 to 2.27, these would allow prospective small generators to be in this legislature. In on lines 2.23 to 2.27, these would allow prospective small generators to be exempted essentially from MISO requirements, and that those would be, presumably be offloaded to the resident utility, whether it's a investor owned or a co-op or a muni. And so that's an important difference in how the world occurs in 2.23 to 2.27. In 2.28 to 2.34, the attempt is to assign to the PUC, the Minnesota PUC, the accountability for determining system values payable to small distributed generation. Now, currently, MISO assigns costs to all generators, including utilities. And so if the next generator, whether it's a utility or a small distributed generation project, creates the need for what's known as a network upgrade, that next next generator has to pay for network upgrades. The requirement to pay for network upgrades is a deterrent to certain small DG projects. We've seen that in our own service territory. They still have to assign accountability to someone for the cost, and ultimately the utility would bear the cost. In lines 2.35 to 3.8, there's an attempt here, as Mr. Evans has identified, to incentivize utilities to proactively promote small distributed generation. But as Mr. Evans pointed out, that cost for the incentives would be paid for by other customers. So you've got customer A, who potentially is benefiting in some way, that payments are being made by customers B, C, and D. And then finally, in lines 3.32 to 4.2, essentially this mandates the electric utilities to annually provide a list of sweet spot, it doesn't use the word sweet spot, but that's kind of the word that's been used in the past, sites on a map or on a list where it would be possible to locate small DG up to 10 megawatts. 10 megawatts is a fairly significant supply. And in most situations that I can think, I'm not a transmission engineer, but I think in most situations that would require a full-scale study of impacts on the local, not just distribution system, but on the transmission system as well. So with these factors in mind, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would discourage your approval of House file before you. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please stick around in case we have time for questions. Our last testifier is Elizabeth Wapel.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Wafel with Flaherty & Hood, and I'm here on behalf of Missouri River Energy Services, a municipal power agency supplying power to 24 member owners in greater Minnesota. We are particularly concerned, and I should say opposed, to Subdivision 4 of this bill, which is the section that most directly applies to municipal electrics. I would have to say we agree with most of the concerns that have been expressed by previous testifiers, but I just want to provide a little bit of perspective on how this might affect municipal utilities. We believe that the requirements of this proposal are simply unworkable for most municipal utilities, at least those who are MRES members. Here's a few simple reasons why. Municipal utilities really don't have that large of load. It's asking us to identify, optimal spots on our distribution for up to 10 megawatts. A lot of our municipal utilities only have a 2-megawatt load and can't really even handle anything close to that. So what it's asking for, we don't think is really even possible for most of our utilities. Secondly, I think you've heard quite a few of these testifiers talk about how complicated it is to put together one of these maps. I think I can safely say that most of our municipalities, municipal utilities, simply do not have the staff to put together this type of map, which means they're going to have to hire somebody, and it's going to be expensive. And these are not large municipal utilities. We really don't want them having to spend the kind of money on something that, as the previous testifiers, I think, have all explained to you, changes. This is not a map that you can have that's constant. It stays in flux. So if it changes when one thing on the grid changes, do we have our municipalities go back in and create new maps? This is really an expensive endeavor for a lot of them. I mean, it really, I think it hits everybody, but it really hits, the municipal utilities. And we're very concerned about how this is going to get paid for. We really believe that this report is just, it's another expensive unfunded mandate that's placed on local communities, and we'd really ask that you reject it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions for any of the last few testifiers or for the author? Any discussion to the bill? Representative Falk, would you like to wrap up?
Madam Chair, and I guess I would ask Mr. Crocker maybe to, I know he worked on the sweet spot study back in 2007, but just, I mean, to maybe offer a little historical context about, you know, I know some of this has been, and I'm willing to work with people. I mean, if the optimal locations is seemingly onerous, but we already required the sweet spot study, and all this was put together in 2007 doing a 10 to 40 megawatt analysis. And so it's not like you're entirely reinventing the wheel. I get a little frustrated when so many of the comments here are blatantly, you know, forgetting some of the things we've already done.
Mr. Crocker, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office, which was instrumental, as Representative Falk mentioned, in passing legislation that required a transmission analysis that for the first time ever actually integrated the higher voltage system with the lower voltage system in the course of doing power flow analysis. A very valuable tool was created because of the good work that this legislature did to enable the engineers to finally no longer be blind, literally and figuratively blind, to the opportunity on the lower voltage system. Well, that study ran its course, and unfortunately, Minnesota was not able to get the full benefit of the actual value that could have been created, because the engineers who did the analysis, after they integrated the higher and the lower voltage system to see what was the opportunity to strategically size and locate new generation at sweet spots, before they ran the model to see what it would accommodate, they loaded it up with every megawatt that was already in the MISO queue, which amounted to over 10,000 megawatts. So they proved conclusively that you can take any transmission model and gum it up if you put enough capacity in it, of generation capacity in it. Recognizing that Minnesota's total capacity requirements are in the neighborhood of less than 10,000 megawatts, if only half of the generation that was in the queue would have been loaded into the model before they ran it to test for strategically sized and located, we would have found certainly several thousand megawatts of opportunity in Minnesota without any new transmission requirements. That's the opportunity. That's what this bill is trying to identify. How can we systematically understand where we can strategically size and locate new generation without new transmission? Thank you.
We have a question. I think it's Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question. I just think it's interesting. I mean, we've seen two bills here today. And the first bill that you presented, we saw how working together, bringing both parties in, the initial proponents were falling all over themselves, complimenting you, Madam Chair, on bringing them to the table and letting them help draft the language. And here we have, although I'm certain that Representative Falk is well-versed in the generation of electricity at a small level, we have what I can imagine only to be 100 years of experience and expertise from the industry saying that this is bad legislation. And so I think there's always a time to bring people to the table to work out a bill, and I don't think it's been done.
Any questions? Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, if this bill does pass out of the committee, though, you are willing to sit down and work with the various stakeholders to improve the bill. Is that right?
Well, Representative Seltzer, absolutely. And once again, I mean, if people have concerns, I think that they've identified some things that they're concerned about, you know, kind of first time me hearing it here, but happy to sit down and work with them. The issue is, and there's so many things here to kind of go through and refute. If you want to hook up right now a 10-megawatt facility in Minnesota through a distributed generation interconnection, you can do it. There are currently tariffs already filed. You can do it. Is the process incredibly onerous, expensive, cumbersome? Yes. What is this aiming to do? Make that process more simple and easier. And the whole, all this talk about MISO and transmission, the whole purpose of this is to avoid that. Is if you're not going to impact the transmission system, you shouldn't have to go through a transmission analysis study. And if you realize that by siting a facility in a particular place where it causes a transmission impact, maybe you don't move forward. And that's why, I mean, some of the comments offered by the utilities are just, I'm stumbling over them. Because if we can identify locations, and getting back to Representative Leon Lilly's bill, when we talked about giving property tax exemptions for facilities owned by municipals, and about all the benefits of DG, they talked about how great it was, how it reduced costs, how it reduced transmission congestion, how it did all these great things, which is true. If those things are good, which they are, why don't we want to go and make that easier for those types of facilities? It could be solar. It could be wind. It could be cogeneration. It could be any number of technologies. This bill doesn't particularly identify anything. Once again, we already have a DG tariff, so the comments made that said we'd have to go in and do a value of every single resource, that's not the case. And I'm just going through, you know, one of the reasons why I personal opinion here that they don't want to identify opportunities is because opportunities are competition. And if you go and show where it's best to go and cite resources that ultimately benefit the system as a whole and bring costs down, you're creating competition that otherwise wouldn't be there. So it's one of the things where we're trying to make the process easier for people to get through, trying to give some certainty in the sense that if it's going to have a transmission impact and you can get that found out up front, maybe you don't move forward because you don't want to go through the multiple year, multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, MISO interconnection process. Going through that transmission interconnection process is onerous. It's incredibly onerous. For these small projects which have no impact on the transmission system, MISO doesn't want to see them anyway. And so keeping it at the distribution level makes a lot of sense.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My opinion is this bill is somewhat one-sided in that it repeatedly is mentioned as savings, but there's no consideration and due diligence that there are costs incurred, and that I do have concerns about, you know, location. Now, do we get into an eminent domain situation of where you force somebody because it's for the good of an entity to locate something? I think that this is something that's a work in progress. It was already stated that there was an expert to be able to answer what the cost might be, but they can say what the savings are. And so I think that if you don't have the full picture, you shouldn't move forward with this bill.
Representative Falk, would you like to vote on your bill today, or did you want to lay it over and bring it back up for a vote later and have an opportunity to work with stakeholders?
This is going to the Commerce Committee where we can continue to work on it. I know that we've got tight deadlines. I'd like to get it moved over there. And like I said, I'm willing to work on that with people, but to Representative Quam's inquiry or point there, if you want to hook up a DG connection right now, you can do it, and you can be paid that tariff rate. What we're doing is asking that tariff rate to reflect the changes that have happened in the last 13 years. And so if there are cost savings or if there are additional expenses, they would be reflected in that tariff rate. But that's the purpose of the Public Utilities Commission. That's what you have to realize.
There's another committee coming into the room, so if you would like a vote on your bill today, Representative Falk, let's do that at this time. Representative Falk renews his motion that House File 1174, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is referred. Representative Scott requests a division. All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. All those opposed to the motion, please raise your hand. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
The committee is adjourned.